Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Thank you for joining us today for this special episode, albeit with a heavy heart, as we remember former guest of the show, friend of the show, and friend of the upland community, Glenn Blackwood, who passed away on December 29th, 2025. Glenn was many things: conservationist, a storyteller, a teacher, a fly angler, a grouse and woodcock hunter. More than anything, he was someone who genuinely cared about wild places and the people who spend time in them. Glenn worked with the Ruffed Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society. His impact on habitat conservation, mentorship is beyond hard to overstate. He had a way of bringing people into the fold, whether that was through a day on the water, a walk in the woods, or simply a good conversation and a storyteller with his booming voice, as the folks at Ruffed Grouse Society put it. If you knew Glenn, you knew that about him. Today's episode is a re-release of my original conversation with Glenn from back in 2022, and it is all about good book recommendations, which if you knew Glenn, you knew he was full of those. He loved books. He wrote book reviews in the Covers magazine, and he was always sharing recommendations. In fact, when I first met Glenn, this was way back when, at a American Woodcock Society event, Glenn was there as the auctioneer, as he often did, and he had some of his treasured books for sale at the event. I spoke with Glenn, didn't know him at the time, but I was asking him about books, and he sold me, which I, of course, still have today, my copy of Come October and Bear November Days, two of my absolute favorite books. I splurged a little bit on them, but I think Glenn gave me a good, honest deal, and today I wouldn't trade them for anything. They're two of my absolute favorite books, and they're a little bit more special now knowing that I got them from Glenn. So today's conversation is all about Goodreads with Glenn Blackwood, and I wanted to replay it for you all today because I think hearing Glenn in his own words feels like the best way we can honor him here on the Birdshot Podcast. If you knew Glenn, I hope this episode brings back a familiar voice. And if you didn't, I hope it introduces you to someone who embodied what so much of this community values: curiosity, stewardship, and generosity. Our thoughts are with Glenn's family, his friends, and everyone who was shaped by his work. And with that said, let us remember and welcome back the voice of Glenn Blackwood on the Birdshot Podcast.
And we are joined on the Birdshot Podcast by Glenn Blackwood. Thanks for joining me today, Glenn. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. Happy to have you here. Happy to chat about some things that kind of have me excited at this point in the year. It's the end of July. I know I'm looking forward, as many listeners are, and I'm sure you are too, Glenn. And I've been reading a lot of sporting literature lately.
Well, I think it's that time of the year where if you're a reader or a lover of books, you're getting anxious. And, you know, it's one of those things where I live in just north of Grand Rapids, Michigan, in Rockford, and we had a cool night and there was dew. And, you know, I was just doing some retriever work and had the puppy on the training table this morning, and it was, you know, comfortable. But in the evenings, what better to do than sit there and read some of the old classics or modern works and get in the mood?
Absolutely. And you mentioned that it was a fairly cool evening here last night. And yeah, once those start piling up this time of year, that will really kind of gets the spidey sense tingling a little bit at that point.
Yeah, it accelerates the adrenaline, if nothing else.
Indeed. Yeah. And one way to jump back into the covers a little bit early is through the pages of a good book, which we will talk plenty about today, but I would like to set the stage a little bit. And Glenn, this is your first time on podcast. You recently were on Reed Bryant's podcast, which I listened to. That it was a great interview. And I interviewed Reed a couple weeks ago, so kind of connecting some dots here, but I'll have some questions for you on books and we will get into that. But why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about you beyond where you're from and kind of what keeps you busy during the day in the world of upland bird hunting, Glenn.
I learned to fish and got my passion for the outdoors from my father, who was a conservation officer in the state of Ohio, and my grandfather, who grew up in central Pennsylvania, about 12 miles to the west of State College. Spent many years in the fly fishing industry, and that's kind of where we developed the book side of things. But then a couple years ago, I took a leap of faith and went to work as a regional development of or director of development for Ruff Grouse American Woodcock Societies under the leadership of Dr. Ben Jones. And for the last 2 years, I've, I guess, going back, paying homage to my upbringing, my father's, my grandfather's, who were all great conservationists, and spending the next few years or my second career in the conservation realms, working for RGS and AWS with young growth forests, forest management, grouse and woodcock, things like that. So that's kind of a very quick synopsis, but exciting things going on in Michigan with RGS. And, you know, everybody says, I'm an Ohio State alumni. How did you get to Michigan? I said, it's three reasons: trout, grouse, and woodcock. And then I met my lovely wife, and she was a Michigander and have been here ever since. So it's a pretty nice place to be.
Yeah, I spent a little bit of time over there, enough to know why there is a fair bit of Michigan pride. Yeah, there's plenty to do there, plenty to see, great place to be. Tell me, I am curious now, you mentioned Ohio, and I think I had probably heard that before, your backstory, but is that, am I safe in assuming that that's where you got your first exposure to the ruffed grouse?
Yes, actually, at that time, southern part of the state, Jackson County being one county down in there, Scioto, Athens, had good populations of birds. And with my father being a conservation officer, through deer season, and at that time, Ohio's grouse season went into January and February, being more temperate. But he was busy with, you know, being a rabbit cop, right, small game hunters, deer hunters, waterfowl hunters during the bulk of the season. But once those things stopped, you know, about Christmas time, every Saturday, we'd find ourselves loading up in the old family station wagon and van, if you will, and headed someplace down south to chase grouse and woodcock.
Heading south to chase grouse and woodcock. That almost sounds strange these days.
Well, I guess more grouse than woodcock, because woodcock would have been out. But yeah.
Was your dad too busy to have dogs back then?
We had labs, but a lot of our friends had setters or pointers. So we were fortunate to hunt over the as well.
Yeah. What do you recall about, and I'm getting at, you know, I don't know a whole lot about Ohio ruffed grouse hunting or the history there, but I feel I have enough sense to know that it obviously it's not what it once was. And I could probably come up with a storyline that might tell the story of why it is not the case, why it is not so good anymore. But being that you grew up there and hunted there, I mean, in your estimation, what have you seen? What did you see change over the years? Or were you there long enough to kind of witness?
Well, I was there through my college years. And then, you know, slightly after graduating from the university, I moved to Michigan.
Yeah,
I think it's all habitat driven, like everything else that goes with that in those areas. But, you know, the bird shooting at that time was, you know, I don't think it would have rivaled the upper Northeast or the upper Great Lakes region, but certainly there were opportunities to be had. And, you know, some days were better than others, but again, wonderful memories of going down there and walking up those hills, you know, and as the old joke is, you always seem to be going uphill, not down, but a lot of good times.
Just like when you're walking to school, uphill both ways, right?
Exactly. You know, and along with that was, you know, we'd always leave where we lived and head down this little state two-lane road. And we'd always kind of pull into like Chillicothe and stop there at the Bob Evans and, you know, get our fill of caffeine and coffee and biscuits and gravy to take us through the day and then again, my eating habits. But, you know, at that time, Kentucky Fried Chicken sold chicken livers and gizzards. And,
no kidding,
you know, we'd always stop on the way home and get buckets of livers and gizzards on this because it took us, you know, 3 hours or so to get down there. So it was always an epic adventure.
Yeah. I don't know how big of a thing chicken livers are. I feel like a lot of people would probably turn up their nose at that, but they're pretty good. If you ever had them bacon wrapped.
They certainly are.
Maybe we're the strange ones. I don't know, Clint. But do you ever keep the livers and gizzards out of grouse?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Sir. I do. I guess I don't keep gizzards as much. I'm kind of curious about it. I've never really done that, but I like opening them up and seeing what's inside.
What's in there.
Yeah. But what do you have a preparation for gizzard? Deep fry?
Well, not really deep fry, but more, you know, get a bunch and, you know, just roll them in Italian breadcrumbs and then pan fry them in a cast iron skillet and eat them as hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah. It kind of sounds like a crispy, tasty snack.
Yeah.
Do you have any memories of first grouse or anything really stand out, kind of solidified, burned into your brain back from the early days in Ohio?
I think I've told this story. I don't know if I told it recently or not, but the big story that always sits in my mind, and certainly there's, you know, grouse, I think the first grouse came, it was like the dog turned and it flushed and it was like a kind of a high house eight just coming straight in there. And, you know, it was probably one of the easier grouse shots I ever had in my entire life. But the one that really is etched in my mind is there was a large agricultural family whose mother of the family happened to be my third grade teacher. Mm. And they had this wonderful farm that had this little creek that ran down through it and had a muskrat marsh on it. And ducks would get in there and pheasants and rabbits and what everything else. And, you know, when your father's the game warden and you give his son fishing and shooting and trapping access to your property, it gets watched over pretty well.
Sure.
So the Troxels gave me carte blanche to this deal. But always remember one Friday, and again, going back to the reading aspect of it, which I do, I'd been given sporting books as birthday presents and Christmas presents over the years, and had read about Woodcock and Gene Hill and Steve Smith and sundry others. But anyway, I'm going in after school to check my trap line, and there's just woodcock everywhere. I mean, you know, and here I am with a pack basket and chest waders and there's woodcock flitting everywhere.
Yeah.
And I am just excited. And I go home and I call my grandfather and I call my dad and say, you're not going to believe this, but a flight of woodcock have landed on the outside of the marsh.
Yeah.
And let's go tomorrow morning. So the next morning comes and overnight temperatures had dropped and we'd got, I don't know, a skiff of snow, maybe an inch, not much more than that. And the woodcock were gone. They were just there and as they are. And it clicked to me about the migration, the mystery of these great little birds. And it was a bust. You know, it was like, you know, the world stood before us and then the world went away. But that's one that etches in my mind. Another one that kind of etches in my mind early on, I don't know how old I was, but my father had been in southeastern Ohio during deer season and working for the state and had met the person who ran the county orphanage. And he invited myself and my father to come back down and hunt with him. And so we go hunt at this thing and we pull in this county orphanage. It's like this long serpentine driveway up on a hill. And here's this big kind of monstrous stone house that's dark and gothic, something out of a Dickens tale or something. And I'm petrified. I am just petrified. But anyway, we go out and we hunt and we hunted along some railroad tracks, believe it or not, on the railroad grade. And he had two setters. One was on the right, one was on the left. There's always blackberry canes and martiful rose and everything in there. And the dogs would go on point, and he would pick up the railroad cinders or rocks and throw them down in front of the dogs to get the birds to flush. And the birds would flush up kind of like a trap shot, like a 16-yard trap shot. And I remember that we shot some birds that day, but it wasn't, I wanted it to be. It was harvesting versus, you know, being in the woods.
But too easy.
The thing that I still walk away from that aspect is that birds like berries. And you find them in those feeding zones when they're feeding patches, and you're going to have some opportunities.
Yeah, hunting along the railroad tracks that and the snowfall and the woodcock, definitely a few nuggets there burned into the mind of Mr. Blackwood. So before we get into dive too deep into sporting literature, I do want to go there. Oh, I was going to ask you this. Your dad, as a conservation officer, you must have been privy to hearing all sorts of tales and things of what not to do in the outdoors.
Oh, yeah. And I have the utmost respect for conservation officers. You know, I can tell you the great stories and the ugly stories. You know, our mailbox was destroyed or blown up. Mm. Picture window shot out. I mean, I can tell you all the good stuff, or the bad stuff, if you will. But there's a lot of good stuff that comes with that, and learning those sporting ethics. And, you know, it all comes down to personal choice, like everything in life. But yeah, you know, and you see it through a lot of different eyes and a lot of different viewpoints. So
did your dad have a favorite bird hunting big game? Like, was there something that stood out as his favorite thing to do when he wasn't being a CO?
Certainly he liked the grouse woods. You know, he liked the grouse woods because of our connection to Pennsylvania and being there, Southern Ohio. Certainly he liked that. He loved spring turkey hunting. So, you know, as turkeys got reintroduced into Ohio, he really enjoyed that. My father was a heck of an angler. I always say my father could land a tarpon on a cane pole, and he'd say, you know, if it wasn't for old Joe the guide, I just got lucky. But yeah, I'm going to digress a little bit, and we'll get back to RGS and that. But the gun club where I grew up and shot at, and this is in the days before automatic traps, where you actually sat in the little bunker and put clay pigeons on there. They had this great pond that was full of big bass and bluegills, but you weren't allowed to fish it. Fishing was off limits. They kept it for like Boy Scout days or 4-H days or disability children, fishing tournaments, inner city kids, things like that. But the general members, you couldn't fish the pond. Yeah. And it backed up to friends of our family's farm. And their daughter, one year, I was 16 at the time because I was driving, but their daughter was having a barn party on a Friday night. And I said, you know, this is going to be kind of cool. Now, I'm son of a game warden, but I am 16 and love to fish. I can like go in the back lane to the farm, jump the fence, fish for a little bit, jump the fence, go to the barn party. No one's ever going to know. So that's my plan. You know,
it sounds like a killer plan.
It sounds like a killer plan. And I go and grab my old Fenwick fiberglass rod and grab my fishing vest. And as I'm walking out, I pass my dad's vest. My dad's got one of those old Betts black and yellow bumblebee poppers on his vest.
Yep.
And I snag this thing, just pluck it right off of his vest. And I go anyway, and I tie this on, and the fishing's pretty good. And there's one point, there's kind of like a little peninsula, a little island that goes out that kind of separates the two. Anyway, so I'm there and I'm catching fish. And again, I'm young and not paying attention to knots in my leaders and what size it is. And I've caught a bunch of fish. Anyway, I make this cast and the popper sets and it gets still. There's no ripples on the water. And I pop it once and the fish explodes. I set the hook and up comes this big largemouth. And he's shaking his heads and gills are flapping and hits the water and he breaks me off. I lose my dad's popper. And I go, okay, well, it's time to go to the barn party. So I reel in, jump the fence, go to the barn party. This is Friday night. Get home. Saturday afternoon, my dad comes in and looks at me and he goes, you know, you really shouldn't be poaching the gun club property. I go, what do you mean? He said, you really shouldn't be poaching the gun club property. The way I figure it, you drove in that back lane of the farm because you're going to the barn party and jumped the fence and thought you'd be a fish and no one would say anything to catch you. And then you jumped the fish, went to the barn party. And I go, well, Dad, you're not allowed to fish the gun club pond. I don't know what you're talking about. And about this time, Nick, he opens his hand like a softball pitch and throws this black and yellow Betts popper across the room, and I catch it. And he looks at me and he goes, I guess I didn't tell you that the Boy Scouts were out doing a shooting thing and they asked me to come out and talk about fly fishing and fly casting and talk about conservation. And he said, you know, I grabbed my vest downstairs and I saw that popper was gone. And I just said, yeah, the kid took it. And he said, so I tie on something else and I'm sitting there talking and I make this cast and I strip the popper and it sits and I strip it again. And all of a sudden this fish tees off and comes up out of the water and he's got my black and yellow popper in his mouth.
My gosh, you can't make that
so
up.
He looks at me and he said, so don't poach the gun club property again. So I'm sitting there like, you know, I'm just, what are you
not much to say at that point?
There's not much to say. And then he kind of smiles at me because he had a really dry sense of humor.
Yeah.
And he said, and if you're gonna keep poaching the gun club property, just tie better knots. That's all he said. And I never fished it again.
Oh,
so learned my lesson.
That is exactly the kind of story I was wanting to hear from the game warden's son. I like how he handled that, though. You know,
yeah,
not much more that needed to be said, and you respected that.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. So fast forwarding, then, well, we'll maybe talk about your dogs a little bit later, but I do want to get a little bit of an RGS update. What have you been doing this summer? Going to shoots? Those chapters are pretty good about putting on summer events, I feel like.
Well, yeah, it's a very exciting time in RGS in Michigan now, as well as it is across the country. You know, before I joined, I worked with the Grand Rapids, Michigan chapter for 30 years as a volunteer. And, you know, coming out of COVID, Ben Jones, our CEO president, you know, coined the phrase conservation isn't canceled. And you know, we've come out of the pandemic well. We're having growth in not only staffing as well as membership, but most important, habitat dollars.
Yeah.
So, you know, the state of Michigan just awarded us with a variety of partners, U.S. Forest Service, Huron Manistee, Conservation Resource Alliance, YouthWorks, $199,980,000 grant with matches over $200,000 for habitat work in the Huron Manistee area or forest, which, if you know where Baldwin, Michigan is, the Pere Marquette River, the project's called the Pere Marquette River Watershed Collaborative. We just got, like I said, over $200,000 for habitat work in that area. We've signed a stewardship agreement with the Federal Forest Service on the Huron Manistee out of the Baldwin Ranger District. We've signed a stewardship agreement in the Western UP on the Ottawa. We just hired a new forest conservation coordinator, Heather, and I believe it's Smurgy. This is the pronunciation of her last name. Heather, if I screwed it up, I apologize. And she's our new forest conservation coordinator for the lower UP.
Okay.
In the eastern Upper Peninsula. Nick Bougie hired in about 6 months ago as the new engagement coordinator. So we've got a full staff on the ground and working on projects across the state. We had a southern woodcock habitat grant was given to us last year. Those dollars are being spent in the field as we speak. Things in the Pigeon River country for projects that we had. So it's a very, very exciting time here in the state with, you know, chapters doing shoots, chapters doing fundraisers, banquets coming up. But really all that effort is getting poured back into boots on the ground and conservation delivery. And that's the most exciting thing.
Yeah. It's good to hear about the staffing updates. I know we have a couple new folks over here that I've been kind of playing phone tag with a little bit. Got to get out and connect with them. We've got some habitat days scheduled in the near future that I'm hopeful to attend, so that's good to hear. And those stewardship agreements keep popping up all over the place, which I might butcher that, but it's basically an agreement for Rough Grouse Society to work on national forest and keep dollars on those national forests going back into habitat. Is that a fair assessment of it, Glenn?
Yeah, it's a very fair assessment of it. What it allows us to do is to go in and do a timber cut. We have the stewardship agreement. So we cruise the trees, mark the trees, execute the contract. And then those dollars, instead of if the Forest Service does it, goes into the general fund, has to stay in that ranger district. Mm-hmm. So then, as people know, or maybe they don't know, but we'll explain, the most expensive part of some of these conservation things are what we call non-commercial cuts.
Yeah.
Shearing alder, doing things that cost money, don't make money. And what's so great about the new RGS model is that it allows us to recycle dollars. We're taking a viable product and putting it onto the market and then using those dollars, recycling them in a sustainable fashion so that we can have the money, the revenue to do non-commercial work, alders and things like that. So then we can take that money and put it back in to do more conservation work, and the process just goes forward and forward. It's a very innovative plan. You know, unlike other conservation plans where you have to raise money and you spend it, this is self-generating. And as the more you do, the more opportunities you have. And John Steigerwalt, the Forest Conservation Director for the Upper Great Lakes, has done a great job with this model in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, now coming to Michigan. And like I said, I've been working with the organization. You know, I did my first RGS charity auction because I'm an auctioneer as well when I was at the university. So that I think I did that in 79 or 80. So it's an incredibly exciting time. We've got a great team, great staff. And, you know, we're just, the snowball is just starting to roll down the hill and pick up momentum and getting larger and larger through each day or week.
Yeah. Good to hear. I know the first time I met you was at AWS event in Michigan. Where was that? Do you remember where that was? It was 2015. It was the Woodcock Challenge.
Yeah. It was probably at 2015. Was that with the International Woodcock Symposium that year, or was that the year before? I think we were up in Gaylord that year. So,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. That sounds about right. I just am blanking on the location, but I remember you were there just as an exhibitor, basically, and you had books for sale. And that's where I got my coveted copies of Bear November Days and Come October.
Two great reads.
Yes. Yes. I want to ask you about those. I guess we'll just jump into that right now, whether or not we stick with it. But Bear November Days, I need to go back and reread it. It's been a couple of years now. That's really like, it's my memory. It's kind of a who's who of grouse writers in that book.
Well, yeah, I think if you look at, and not to kind of self-promote myself, if you look at a couple of years ago, my Pages Past article that I write for Upland Almanac magazine, looking at past wingsheen writers, I did a whole piece on that series of anthologies that Country Sport did.
Okay.
There's Bear November Days, which is the grouse anthology. Come October, which is the woodcock anthology. Call of the quail anthology. Oh. Pheasant Tales is the pheasant hunting anthology. And then they did a couple dog anthologies for the love of the dog. And for people that are looking to get started in sporting literature, I know from a classical literature pieces, a lot of people don't like anthologies. Myself, I love anthologies.
I do too.
As a little kid, again, going back, you know, my favorite book was and I still have it, the Treasury of Outdoor Life. It's this big, robust book that had great stories from magazine articles from Outdoor Life in it. And there's everything from African adventures to Yukon, Alaskan adventures to ducks and quail and fishing and the whole nine yards. But, you know, the great thing about anthologies is it allows you to, it's like a giant smorgasbord or buffet, and it allows you to taste or delve into one person's writings and then see if you want to follow that person and read more. So again, looking at those Country Sport pieces, There'll be a Gene Hill piece, a Steve Smith piece, a Michael McIntosh piece, a Ted Lundgren piece, Brian Bilinski piece. I mentioned Steve Smith. I don't know who I'm just going off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I don't have the book in front of me right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it's a laundry list.
But yeah, it is kind of the who's who of that mid-80s, late-80s, early-90s sporting writers. And the great thing about that is they're all original stories. They had never been reprinted. They weren't reprints. They'd never been published in any other form.
Right.
They're all original stories.
I did not know. I wanted to get a little bit more of the story on Country Sport Press. And I think, I want to say I was, did they do Whispering Wings of Autumn?
Whispering Wings of Autumn was originally done by Willow Creek Press.
Okay, okay.
And then I think it was reprinted by Wilderness Adventures Press. There is a Wilderness Adventures imprint of that book.
Okay. Well, that's a side note then. We'll get to that because I've got that book as well, and that's a great one. And I know, I believe it was a recent Upland Almanac issue that you wrote about Whispering Wings of Autumn. But as far as Country Sport Press goes, they're no longer around. Is that correct? Or are they?
They're no longer viable. They've been sold numerous times over the years. And Shooting Sportsman magazine owned them at one time, and then they were sold to someone else.
I guess I'd never really looked into it, but I was going to ask you at some point, like, what would be the bare November days of different bird species? And it sounds like they did a quail one, and they did a pheasant one.
Yeah, they did pheasant tails, call to the quail is the quail one, woodcock. Yeah. And then For the Love of Dog is the dog anthology.
Are those easy to find or relatively easy to find?
They're relatively easy to find.
Okay. What's like the most, because I know when I bought the Bear November Days and Kamak, I mean, they weren't cheap. It was for charity, but is it, what's like the most coveted of those Country Sport anthologies?
Probably Come October and Bear November Days.
Yeah.
Those two are probably of the anthologies. I think if you look at Country Sport Press as a whole, probably some of Ted Lundgren's early works would be there, either in a trade or a limited edition, and some of McIntosh's works, you know, especially on the limiteds. McIntosh had what he called caliber copies. So, like, on the limited editions of those, like, when he talked about double rifles there, 47 would be, like, the caliber copy for 470 Nitro. So some of those things are a little obscure and out there a little ways. But, you know, you got to look at that time. They were publishing Michael's three shooting books, Shotgunner's Notebook.
They did Gene Hill Shotgunner's Notebook, too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's on my list to reread perhaps before the season. I am just before we started recording this morning, I'm about a chapter or two from the end of McIntosh's Shotguns and Shooting Volume 2. Mm-hmm. And I read the first one maybe a year ago, and those are, I mean, they're quickly near the, I've got the third one too, so I'm going to jump into that, but those are perhaps some of my favorite shotgun books.
Well, you know, you look at it, and Michael was a tremendously talented writer.
Yeah.
But he was also a Shakespearean scholar. I mean, he taught Shakespearean literature and had studied that greatly before he got into writing for conservation and writing on the shooting side. He was also very knowledgeable in the world of shotguns and double guns and a tremendous shot.
Yeah.
So he's able to take those nuances and blend them together. You know, it's all the classic sporting writers that are out there are all first and foremost professional writers that then blend their understanding of the outdoors in to make those magical phrases or those magical moments in print.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why Burton Spiller is the, you know, as he is, or William Hardin Foster or McIntosh or Hill or whoever. So,
yeah. I mean, I hope many of these names are not foreign to listeners, but if they are, I almost envy that, because you've got a whole world out there that you can go and explore. And that's part of why I wanted to bring you on the show today to drop some names and titles and things that people could check out if they're interested again in this time of year.
One quick thing while we're on that subject.
Yeah.
Michael McIntosh for Wildlife Art News wrote a column where he did biological sketches or profiles of a broad variety of animals, birds, mammals, and it was put into a book called Wild Things.
And oh, I have that book.
I personally, going out on a limb.
Who's the author of that book? Do you know?
McIntosh. Michael McIntosh.
Okay. I gotta check my copy of it because I thought it was John something. I have a...
You're thinking of Wild Ones.
Okay. There we go. Yep.
That's John Taylor.
Okay.
Wild Things is this collection of biological sketches.
Okay.
That came out of his column in Wildlife Art News. And it's one of his more obscure books, but I personally, because I like natural history books, and, you know, y'all know I like shooting books, but I think it's probably his best work in totality from start to finish. So, anyway.
Is it all, like, North American animals, or?
Oh, no, there's some outside of the North American animals.
Interesting. I've leaned into his shotgun writing, which I think is the bulk of it, but I know he did other stuff. Did he ever do like a bird hunting specific book, like more so bird hunting than shotguns? Obviously, they're kind of, he melds them very well, but.
The closest would be The Traveling Sportsman.
Okay. Okay.
Which had tales of upland bird shooting, driven European bird shooting, and some fly fishing stuff in it.
Okay. To jot that one down, that would be worth checking out. Okay, so one quick little nugget here. You mentioned turkey hunting earlier, and this is something that as I've got into turkey hunting a little bit more in the last few years, I've started to wonder about the sporting literature scene. Because I've been reading grouse books for a long time, rough grouse hunting. That was one of the ways that I could, when I was younger, before we had access to all sorts of other stuff, you know, you go get a book or a magazine, and we kind of lived and died by those, as you well know. What is the turkey hunting literature scene? Is there kind of that romantics?
Oh, certainly. And probably the premier expert in the world is Jim Casada.
Okay.
Out of South Carolina. He knows a heck of a lot more about turkey books than I do. Tom Kelly, who's a very known author, leads the way. But yes, there's certainly its own little niche, if you will, of turkey hunting books out there.
Yeah,
that's not one that I followed throughout my career as much as I have, game bird and fly fishing titles.
Gotcha. Okay. So Whispering Wings of Autumn, let's talk about that one a little bit because you reviewed it. And that is, it's a collaboration between Steve Smith and Gene Hill, who I think I learned in that book that those two were in they were all kind of buddies, I guess. You know more about that than I do, but just a really, really neat compilation. I think they trade off stories. I think it's one Steve and then one Gene Hill through the whole book. And it's really just a neat mix of stories about, is it primarily woodcock or is it both grouse and woodcock?
It's both grouse and woodcock.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, I think Gene Hill and Steve Smith were friends. They wrote together, and that's one of those, I wouldn't call it an anthology as much as it's a dual authorship, but you get a variety of flavors going back and forth with that wonderful, wonderful little book.
I think it's Gene Hill that he writes this. It's almost like you don't really know where it's going, but it's this fictional tale that he picks up a woodcock on the side of the road, and then he drives the whole migration with this woodcock on the dashboard.
Yeah, the bird's on the dashboard.
Yeah.
And he writes his letter home to his wife, describing how he went out to get a gallon of milk, and this bird hopped up on his on there, and they're in Louisiana, and he was sure that they'll start home in a few weeks. it's quintessential creativeness that you find in Gene Hill's writing.
Yeah, indeed. And that you've got to be pretty well steeped and immersed in it to write something like that, and it's very apparent when you read through that. Have you ever read a book called Timberdoodle Tales by Tom Waters?
Out of Minnesota, certainly have.
Yeah. Do you know anything about him or the book or anything come to mind?
I believe Tom worked for the Minnesota DNR.
Okay, I think that's right. Yeah.
It was originally privately published, and then I believe they did the reprint was done by Safari Press out of California.
Okay.
But it's a wonderful little book regarding woodcock in Minnesota.
Yeah, it's kind of a pet favorite of mine. There's a local guy, well, in Minnesota, he's a big sporting library, and I would, when I was working for the Ruffed Grouse Society, I'd do banquets over there. Ted Lundgren was part of that chapter, so I got to meet him, who obviously we lost him in the last year. But I got to meet him and some of those other guys, and one of them would always have, he would have books for sale, and I bought this little woodcock book library from him, and that included Timberdoodle Tales. And so I've, you know, over the years made my way through these books. And that one, I don't know if it's because it's Minnesota or it's a great book, but it just, I just love the stories in that, and they're very unique. There's a good bit of grouse in it too, but it's not one that you would hear about. You know, it's not a huge name, and it's a great book. I usually reread it once every couple of years at least.
Well, there's a lot of books like that are out there.
Yeah.
And again, when you stumble across them, it makes it enjoyable. But again, what I said earlier about blending experiences and writings together. I think the author did that very well there. You have to have enough experience,
yep,
to know what you should write about and what you shouldn't write about. And I'm not much of a writer. I mean, I struggle with that. But you really have to know what you're writing about and then be able to put it. Because there's only so many ways that you can say the dog went on point.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, he was rigid as a cemetery marker, or, you know, whatever. And there's only so many ways to describe a flush. But what you find is the stories within the stories, the dialogue, the character development. I'm a big fan of John Tanner Foote. He wrote a book called Jing that was done by Derrydale Press. It's a great dog story. And it's the dialogue in it's great. Ray Holland's books also fit into those categories. Those are from the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s. But, you know, being able to blend those two together.
Yeah.
And, you know, Timberdoodle's Tales is one of those titles where you see the quality of writing, but you also see the experience that's overlaid in how he describes the event. Right, wrong, or indifferent.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the more experience you gain personally, that's where, you know, you go back and you reread a book and things resonate with you differently. It's how the experience blends with the quality of writing. And I think most people are, you never quite know how a book is going to strike you, but when it does, it's impactful.
Well, and I think the thing that you see is that as one gets more experience or ages, or as he or her develop by rereading things, you may get a whole nother level.
Yes.
You know, a whole nother level of flavor and unami, whatever you want to say, with the book the second time around. It's like The Short and Happy Life of Francis McComber, the classic Hemingway short story. I probably first read in probably high school, before high school, certainly before time at the university. And, you know, it was a safari, you know, the first time I read it, being young and naive, you know, it was a safari tale of a hunting accident. And then later in life, after relationships and loves lost, or whatever you want to say, heartbreak, you see it a different way. And then, you know, after being married to my lovely wife for 30 years, you can see it in a third fashion. Hopefully my wife doesn't shoot me. but neither here nor there. But the story is the same, but your perspective, I guess, is changing.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, that's one of the, you know, there's so many books that it's a never-ending problem. There's always another new fascinating book to read, but then there's something to reread, and I guess you've just got to be okay with both of them. And we can't read them all, can we?
But we sure as heck can try.
Yes, indeed we can. Okay, so this is a burning question for me, and similar to what I asked you about turkey hunting, and hopefully maybe there's something here, but sharptails. There doesn't seem to be, or at least I just haven't come across it, there doesn't seem to be nearly the romance as the ruffed grouse and the, you know, the volume of literature. But what am I missing? Are there books out there? Is there a Bare November Days of sharptail grouse hunting? What else? What is there?
No, there's not really a lot of literary books. Yep. That's out there. There's scientific studies, of course. One Andy Amon did on sharptails in Michigan years ago that was a DNR publication.
Cockbook.
There's a book called, it's a Wisconsin-based book. I'm drawing a blank here, Nick. This is embarrassing.
Your recollection is Bruce, dang good.
Spruce grouse and sharptails a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, something yellow.
I got to jot that down.
Anyway, but here's the thing and McGuane has written some essays about hunting out there for sharptails and huns.
Yeah.
Harrison did some things. Ben Williams has done some things, but combined into that. But here's what it goes back to, at least in my mind. It's about romance and dreams. Why are there so many volumes written on Atlantic salmon fishing or trout fishing that are lyrical versus largemouth or catfish or bluegills or crappies? Mm. It's because early on in the genre of sporting literature, if you want to call it a genre, I believe it is, and one that should be studied, is that people with time and opportunity, wealth, went fly fishing. They were also schooled. And they wrote about it.
Yeah.
And the good ones rose to the top. The same thing with grouse and woodcock hunting, starting back with Edmund Davis's woodcock shooting book. Versus, you know, it's one thing to write romantically regarding the, you know, and I'm just going to throw out a bunch of words here. the autumn breeze.
Yes.
and the fading sunset on
golden October.
You know, leaves or amber colored forest floor, whatever you want to say. Okay. It's much harder to talk about or write romantically about slogging through a cattail marsh for pheasants in a pair of farm boots and Carhartts. And I'm not trying to be discourage anyone. But that's where it comes in. And, you know, nothing's been done. You know, Worth Mastison did some chucker stuff out west, but as a full anthology going back to, there's really not a lot out there.
Yeah. I think that probably is the story that I would have come up with. And I think what you were kind of getting at too was, you know, in order for all of this literature to exist on ruffed grouse, you had a lot of people in the East and the Northeast that were. Again, they had their basic needs met so they could go to school and they could do these other things. Whereas out west, that was probably not the case. You know, people living out there had a lot of other priorities than hunting sharptails and writing, you know, books about them. And even Ben Williams in his books, he talks about when he moved out there and wanted to hunt birds, he was like, one of very few people that was even hunting birds out there. So there just isn't the history of pursuing them in the way that we do now as there was like in New England, right? Just really interesting. What about Charlie Waterman? Was he a Western writer? I've never read his books, but I've heard them highly recommended often.
Well, Charlie Waterman lived in Livingston.
Okay.
Part of the year and in Florida part of the year and did write about Western wing shooting. As well as shooting quail, teal, doves in Florida. He kind of spent the summer months in September and the winter months in Florida.
Yeah.
He was an early writer in Grays.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, I'm going to have to, while I edit this, I'm going to have to go out and make sure I buy any of the books that we talk about here, Glenn, before I publish this. There's one grouse writer that I feel like, I mean, there's more than one, but one that seems to have evaded me only because I just haven't gone out and bought a copy of one of his books and read it, but Tap Tapley, I believe. What do you know about him?
Well, I wouldn't say Tap Tapley was much more known for his, you know, sporting notes and things. Now, he hunted with Burton Spiller, and Spiller refers to Tapley a fair amount. And then Bill Tapley, his son, who did some sporting writing as well as murder mysteries based in the Northeast, wrote a little book about hunting with his sportsman's father, about hunting and fishing with him and all of those people, but along the way. Frank Woolner, of course, wrote his grouse book and his woodcock book.
Yep.
So
I just picked up a cop. What's his grouse book called?
The Rough Grouse.
The Rough, yeah. I bought that around Christmas, and it's in my stack of books to read. I have his Complete Guide to Woodcock Shooting. I think I read that one. He wrote a handful.
That's a reprint and renamed. The original book was called Timberdoodle.
Okay. All right. So The Rough Grouse and then Timberdoodle. Okay. Yeah. And I know that one of the reasons I went out and picked up that book, because I was really interested. I didn't know this, I don't think, reading the woodcock book, but he somewhat famously hunted grouse without a dog and was kind of not into the whole idea of hunting them with dogs.
Yeah, he was a little contrarian, if you will.
Yeah.
It's a good word for someone from the Northeast.
Yeah. All right. I got a couple things here, and we're working towards a conclusion. New books, anything new coming out? I heard you mention on the podcast with Reed, Mike Gaddis. He's been recommended to me a number of times. I don't have any of his books, but he's still writing books, right?
Yeah, he's still writing books. I mean, Jenny Willow and Zip Zap are two of his. He did a little private release a couple years ago, but he's still writing. He writes for Sporting Classics magazine.
Okay.
Still doing some things. There was a book called Grouse Points that was done by a gentleman here in Michigan named Ken McIntyre, excuse me.
Correct. Yep, I did interview him. I read that one.
That's an interesting, it's a nice little read. The cool thing about that is all the artwork, his wife's a very talented needlepoint person, so the artwork is theirs of her, not only original design by hand, but instead of thinking of a flat piece of art that's, you know, painted in oils or acrylics or watercolor, she does it with thread and yarn, which I found incredibly, incredibly interesting.
When I realized I was looking at a needlepoint, like, my mind was blown, because I was totally looking at it as a painting, and then eventually you pick up that it's needlepoint. It's like,
that's one that's out there.
Yep.
Off the top of my head, nothing really that's just all one related. There's some pieces out there that, you know, cross-pollinate with other sports or other natural history.
Yep. I did pick up a copy of, based on, you mentioned it with Reed, Tattered Autumn Sky by Tom Davis, who's definitely one of my favorite magazine article writers that I've been reading. I didn't know he wrote that book until you mentioned it, but eager to read that one. I mean, the nice thing is you really can go out and find copies of most of these books pretty easily.
Oh, yeah. I mean, go to the internet or, you know, however you want to source things. But, you know, they certainly are out there and available. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, it's the quest. Going to used bookstores, which I don't do much anymore, or, you know, looking at collections, since RGS has taken the bulk of my time. But, you know, part of it is finding, you know, trying to build that collection and finding those pieces of the puzzle to fill in. So.
Do you have a shop storefront? I thought you did at one point.
We did at one time. We still have some books and doing some stuff online. My wife's running that.
Okay.
But I'm full-time with RGS and, you know, we're not doing shows anymore like we used to. And I don't want to say we're winding it down, but I'm not active in that as much.
Got it. But if we put a bug in anybody's ear about a certain title, they could get in touch with you.
Yeah, they can get in touch with me. Probably the best way for RGS conservation-related questions is glennb@roughgrousesociety.org on the conservation side. If you had any book questions, you can reach me, my personal email, glennrblackwood @gmail.com. Glenn with one N, GLEN, rblackwood@gmail. Be the way to get to me. Or through the RGS website, roughgrousesociety.org.
Okay. Do you have a website at all for the for your bookstore or books?
No, I do not.
Okay, gotcha. All right. What's the last book you put down, do you recall?
The last book I finished is a wonderful book called The Eloquence of Sardines by Bill Franco. He's a French gentleman. Francois. It's just a wonderful natural history look at a variety of fish species. This gentleman's a physicist. He studies how fish sounds move underwater, but it looks at a whole variety of tropical fish, ocean fish. Majority of them are saltwater-based fish. But yeah, The Eloquence of Sardines has nothing to do with bird shooting at all, but a tremendously interesting and enjoyable read. So that's the last one that I finished up.
Got it. All right. Okay, so bird season approaching. If you were going to pick up a bird shooting book, what might that be? A title or two that come to mind to get you amped up for the season?
Depends on where you're hunting, what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you're looking at a modern writer, I like Making Game by Guy de Lauvigne. I also like his quail book, A Handful of Feathers. I like his Western book, A Fragrance of Grass. I like his writings a lot, especially...
Who's the guy that wrote Meditations on Hunting?
That's Ortega, the Spanish philosopher.
Jose Ortega, that's right, yeah.
So that would be one. I think if you're in the grouse realm, either New England grouse hunting or Spiller's Grouse Feathers, More Grouse Feathers. If you're a big woodcock aficionado, The Fall of Woodcock by Tom Hugler is a tremendous read. If you like pheasants and you haven't read Pheasants of the Mind by Datus Proper, that's the most lyrical, spectacular pheasant hunting book ever done.
Pheasants of the Mind.
Pheasants of the Mind.
All right. Yeah, I see. I got to go get all these now before I publish this. Sorry, listeners.
So
I'm just one guy, though.
Yeah, those would be ones that, you know, jump up out of there.
I was going to ask you kind of by species, so I'm glad you went there. What about quail? We mentioned the Country Sport Press Quail Anthology. Yeah. I'm really curious about that.
Val Dean's A Handful of Feathers is a tremendous quail book.
Yep.
It's very, very lyrical.
And then you briefly touched on chucker earlier. Is there a chucker book that comes to mind?
No, there's just, you know, essays that are out there, but nothing start to finish on those.
Gotcha. All right, Glenn. Well, we could go on, but we will. Why don't we save it for another season past, another year of experience, and another year of perspective gained, and we'll touch on some of these titles again in the future.
Look forward to it. Everybody have a safe and blessed bird season. And as you are out there traipsing away, please think about the conservation efforts that are going on. And, you know, if you're grouse and woodcock inclined, please join or support the Rough Grouse or American Woodcock Societies or any of the other strong conservation aspects are out there. Because without our volunteerism and conservation dollars at work, we're going to be lacking as we go forward.
Indeed.
Leave on a somber note, but
roughgrousesociety.org. Absolutely. Last year, 2021 was the 60th anniversary, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. 60 years and still going.
And still going strong, stronger than ever.
That's good. That's good. Now I forgot to ask you this earlier. This will be we'll end on this, but being that you are out and about talking to many a Michigan bird hunter, what are you hearing? What's the optimism or anecdotal reports at this point?
Well, certainly, like everything else, until you're in the woods full time and you're not going to go. There seemed to be a fair amount of drumming this year throughout the state, both the northern lower and into the UP. I would say what has me most excited is versus the past 2 years is that by and large, we had very, very good weather during nesting or brooding season.
Yep.
I think, you know, can talk about a lot of things, and I'm not a biologist, but when you have birds on the nest and you get another 2 foot of snow and then it ices over and it sticks on the ground for a week, 10 days,
not good.
In, you know, late April, early May, that doesn't bode well. So this year we've had a good brood nesting season. I think we've had just enough moisture that we're going to have grasshoppers.
Yeah.
We're going to have insects for them to bud and nest on, or eat on and grow.
Yeah.
So I think, by and large should be pretty strong. Or I'm being optimistic that it should be pretty strong. I'm always that way.
Yeah.
You know, on the woodcock side of the coin, we've got a little local county park, maybe 10 minutes from our house, that there's always a bird or two in there singing in the spring. And, you know, this year we had six or seven. Now, is that because it was colder temperatures up north and they just stopped here?
Right.
Population increase? I don't know. But, you know, hope springs eternal when there were that many birds there singing this on evenings this spring.
Yeah, small sample size anecdotal reports, but hey, we cling to those this time of year, and I'm right there with you. It does feel like there were a lot of check boxes in the pro column, I think, weather-wise and condition-wise this year over here. Has it been drier over there now? Because I feel like we've had quite a bit of rain in a good way, but I was talking to a customer of ours at Upland Gun Company the other day in Michigan, and he said it's been fairly dry of late.
I think it depends on where...
Sure.
You locate in the state. It's been fairly dry around here, but we had a big storm come through over the weekend, and we got over 2 inches of rain in a short period of time, which isn't great. You know, I just always want those, you know, steady rains that start at 10 o'clock and end by 5:30 in the morning. You know, rain's all nice and steady. But there have been some passes of weather that have gone south of us and a few that have gone north. I think overall we're in pretty good shape.
Good deal. Glenn, well, I want to thank you for taking some time to chat with me and the listeners of the Birdshot Podcast. I really appreciate it. Thanks for what you do for the Ruffed Grouse Society. Keep up the great work, and thanks for dropping some knowledge with us on sporting literature.
Not a problem. Thank you.
All right, Glenn. You have a great day.
Take care. Bye.
Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.